From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Trump EPA is ready to weaken mileage and pollution standards for the auto industry. So what's ahead for electric vehicles?
Automakers are going to have to continue on their course of more fuel-efficient, less polluting vehicles regardless.
A former student reacts to criminal charges against former MSU Dean William Strample.
I wasn't overly surprised. I think I was more shocked that he was actually finally arrested.
And new details from the MSU police investigation into Larry Nassar.
We're able to take a beat and look at what it was that actually brought Nassar to justice. And hopefully that will give us lessons on how to be able to stop this in future cases.
And we'll talk to John U. Bacon and figure out how can Michigan beat Villanova in tonight's NCAA final. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, new details from the MSU police investigation into Larry Nassar. We'll hear the latest from Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. But first, the Trump administration continues rolling back regulations set under the Obama administration. This time, it's looking like it could be fuel efficiency and pollution standards for the auto industry. Let's talk about what weakening of the federal targets might mean as we welcome Michelle Krebs, Detroit-based executive analyst for Auto Trader. Michelle, these guidelines were one of President Obama's signature moves to fight climate change. The Trump administration frames this as eliminating a regulatory burden on the auto companies, and that, they say, will lead to more affordable vehicles for consumers. Is that true?
Oh, it's so much more complicated than that. Let's go back. So in 2012, the Obama administration's EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, back then set a goal that cars and light trucks would average 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. And in that, they had a provision that they would reevaluate that goal beginning in 2017 and then make a decision by April 1st, 2018, which is where we are. When the Obama administration left office, they said, oh, they've made progress. We can eliminate that midterm review. We never agreed with that because we thought that was part of the deal. And the environment in 2012 was far different than now. So now we do have the midterm review. They have concluded, apparently, that the 2025 standards are too high, and they want to roll them back. We do not know the details of what will be rolled back just yet, but we expect it any minute.
Now, is weakening the mileage and pollution standards something automakers want as much as President Trump seems to think they do? Because we heard Ford's two top execs, you had Bill Ford and Jim Hackett, writing, we support increasing clean car standards through 2025 and are not asking for a rollback. So what's happening here?
Well, I think they wanted some flexibility. Here is the big issue in the United States. California has far stricter standards. They will be stricter going forward. There are a dozen states that follow what California does. California's dug in and said, we are not rolling them back. And so we are set up into this two United States. The industry will have to address California and these other states, which represent a third or more of the cars that are sold, and the rest of the country. In addition, China is mandating more fuel-efficient, less-emission vehicles. They're going heavy into electric vehicles, and so the global standards are different. So automakers are going to have to continue on their course of more fuel-efficient, less-polluting vehicles regardless.
Regardless of what happens with the Trump EPA.
Right. And, you know, I will say there's one issue that never gets talked about in any of this, and it's the concern that we have is somehow we have to figure out how to get consumers to buy these kinds of vehicles. First of all, hybrid sales have gone way down as EVs have come into the market, but it's still only 3% of the market or less for all of those more fuel-efficient vehicles. I don't think anyone in 2012 anticipated gas prices would be under $3 a gallon. And so we've got to figure out ways to get consumers to buy the more fuel-efficient vehicles. How do you create consumer demand? And I'm not seeing that addressed.
Well, certainly environmental groups are so concerned that about that very fact, will progress continue toward EVs, cleaner emissions? But they're also fearing that the Trump EPA relaxing these standards will open the door to automakers pushing for relaxed standards all around the world, leading to more emissions and more pollution worldwide. Do you think that would happen?
I don't think that's going to happen. China's the leader. They want to be the leader in electric cars. I think what could happen is that the U.S. isn't the place to develop all this technology, and that China will ultimately be the winner in developing this, because they will keep pushing. Europe will keep pushing. So I don't think the technology will slow down in terms of its development, but it may well slow down here. And it may be, if you're a car company and the rules are more relaxed here and they're more stringent in China, where you're, for example, a Cadillac sells more cars in China than it does in the U.S., where are you going to put your investments in electric vehicle research and development? So I think that's the danger to the U.S.
And is that what you see through these rollbacks? I mean, what do you think these rollbacks that the Trump administration is pushing would mean to Michigan's economy?
You know, we have global automakers. You know, Ford is moving forward. GM is moving forward. They are not changing what they're doing in terms of more fuel-efficient vehicles, less polluting vehicles, because they know that we're a little bit out of step in the U.S. with the rest of the world. So they will march on. So I think it will just continue.
So I think that what I hear you say is the big challenge for our automakers here in the U.S. is the fact that a third of the market is following California's lead, and so they're basically dancing to two very different tunes.
Very different. And what they really wanted was to bring the national rules together with California. But California is not going to accept a rollback of the federal rules. They might have been willing to come down a bit to meet the national ones, as I read it, but they're not willing to roll back with the national standards, and they've made that really clear.
And I would expect court fights when they
undoubtedly.
Start. Undoubtedly.
Undoubtedly.
Michelle Krebs is executive analyst with Auto Trader. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And now it's on to the championship game for Michigan. One last game stands between the Wolverines and their first NCAA title since 1989. So let's talk about that Saturday win over Loyola and tonight's final against Villanova. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubanks is here with us. But real quick, how about that Notre Dame women's team winning the NCAA title with that three-pointer from Arike Ogunbowale? She beat Mississippi State at the final second with that shot. Does it get any better than that?
As the sport grows, college women's basketball, that will become one of the most historic weekends in the sport's history. UConn has this unbelievable, dominating team. And Notre Dame did it twice. Same woman, of course, both times. So,
and they were down at one point in the final at 15 points down.
Which is incredible. Google this thing, by the way, and see the energy in the building. And it's really quite incredible. And by the way, that shot's the same for the men as it is for the women. Just as hard, trust me.
All right, over to the Wolverines. So Saturday night against Loyola, the Ramblers were leading 29-22 at halftime. Michigan shot, 29% in that first half. Down 10 points in the second half at one point. So what happened there?
Defense is the main thing. The shooting got better in the second half, but not that much better. It's defense that they play against these teams. Now, look, in the five games they've won to get to the final tonight, in four of them they've shot very, very poorly. But in all five, they have played great defense. This is a new thing that Beilein has added with his new assistant coach, and they would have lost these games a year ago. So hats off to them, not tonight. They better do a lot more than that.
Because certainly it's probably fair to say that they are not favored against Villanova.
I think the official line is 6, and I think almost everyone thinks it's going to be more than that. Villanova was on fire on Saturday night. It's 22-4
and
first few minutes.
They went through Kansas Saturday like a buzzsaw with those three-point shots.
Kansas, keep in mind, by the way, is one of the four best teams in America. And Michigan right now, maybe they are now, but they were not ranked that way, of course. So that was supposed to be a heavyweight title fight, you know, one seed versus one seed, and they blew through them in like 8 minutes, and the game was over. Incredible performance.
So what does Michigan need to do to be the team cutting down the nets tonight, besides having Mo Wagner firing on all cylinders?
Mo Wagner's your key, obviously. And his mom, by the way, is undefeated whenever she flies in for the games from Germany. She is 6-0, and she's there tonight.
Okay.
So the odds, right there, the odds improve. They've got to play the kind of defense they've been playing so far. They got to keep that up. And the kind of offense they've not played so far, they've got to make their shots. They got to score 70-plus tonight, I believe, because Villanova is too damn good.
Just too good. I liked a comment John Beilein said in the post-game news conference after beating Loyola. He said, I feel guilty sometimes about some of the games we've won because we've had this grace fall on us all of a sudden. What do you like about the way Beilein has coached this team to get them to this point?
By the way, that's a true Catholic guy right there.
It is. A good Jesuit education.
Good Jesuit feels guilty over winning. Come on, dude.
Yeah.
But he knows. I mean, he's not stupid that, you know, they've gone to the well a few times in these games. But they've been lucky. They've been good. They've been smart. And tonight they've got to hit the shots. But look, it's one game. And that's the beauty part for Michigan. You don't have to play six great games. You got to have to win them. That's all. And now tonight you're going to have to play a great game. This will be the only time in this tournament they've had to play truly a great game on both sides of the ball. And they're about to, I think. I think this game's going to go down to the wire.
Wow. I want to throw in one last note about the Saturday night game, that beautiful moment being shared all over social media with Jordan Poole after the game, freshman guard chasing down the hall after Loyola's team chaplain, Sister Jean, and saying to her, I'm a big fan of yours. You did an amazing job.
Jordan Poole is a freshman about 18. She's 98. She's got 80 years in the man. And he chased her down to say thanks. And she was very gracious in return. Look, that's a feel-good story. Even if they lost the game on Saturday night, the good they have done for Loyola. Watch the admissions. Applications are going to skyrocket. Gifts are going to skyrocket. So that's one argument for this basketball thing. But it's just so much fun to watch. And how the school came together. I've been driving past that school every month for years on the way to Evanston and so on, mm-hmm. and not giving it much thought. And now you got to. And now I know the mascot. The mascots are the Ramblers.
And again, boy, I'll tell you, Jordan Poole, there's a lad who was raised well.
Agreed.
So you're going to the game tonight.
I am.
You're getting out of plane. You're going to watch it. And then you're coming back.
Right back tonight. Same clothes. I'm stupid.
So we will have you here tomorrow to break it all down.
I'll be tired, but I'll be here.
We'll look forward to it. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, we look at the state of the housing market in Grand Rapids and West Michigan.
The people who are interested in selling their house in 2018 won't let us put their home up for sale until we find them one to buy.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Many American Indian tribes have radio stations, but this is the 21st century, so how about a podcast? Kyla Carnero is the digital communications specialist for the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. This tribe makes its home in southwest Michigan and northeastern Indiana. Kyla is host and producer of this podcast called Yashomen. Now, Kyla, what does that word Yashmonen mean?
Yashmonen is the Potawatomi word for stories, and that's the traditional language that the Pokagon people speak.
And that is exactly what you want to try to do with this, is in this monthly podcast, is to tell stories. But first of all, where did this idea come from?
Well, our chairman, John Warren, approached us in the communications department, and he was talking about a radio station, something to just connect more with citizens. And in reservations in the West, they have radio stations because their citizens live close together. They need the same information, but our land is parceled. So we don't have a lot of citizens living nearby. So this was a way for us to communicate with citizens where they could access it on their computers, on their phones.
Okay, so linking people together, the citizens of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. But also, I'm sure you are hoping that people who are not Native will listen and become aware of issues and concerns.
Yeah, that's definitely a secondary priority, and we have seen a lot of that, whether it's people who work at local museums or libraries have reached out and said, oh, hey, I listened to this episode. I had no idea this about you guys. And so it has definitely been a learning tool. And then among citizens, it's been an opportunity for them to give each other a pat on the back and, oh, hey, congrats on, you know, graduating and, you know, great job with your work for the Navajo people. You know, it's people are able to connect with each other in a way that they wouldn't have known otherwise because they don't live all close together.
So what kinds of stories does the tribe want to hear in this podcast? And what kind of stories are you looking for?
You know, there's not a specific type because at first I think I was thinking more thematically, you know, what can we find someone to talk about this? And we did that a couple times with episode 2, Boys with Braids. And we had a big event happening to empower young men who are growing their hair long, which is traditional in Native communities, but it can also be a point of teasing among their peers. So it was a time to really empower them. And so we found someone who could share about his experience having long hair as a kid, being teased, but how he feels about it now. But then as we kept going, we were just started finding citizens who had good things to share. You know, when a citizen went to Standing Rock to protest the pipeline, we're like, we have to talk to Terry. You know, she, what a story. And when we found out a citizen had been adopted as a young girl, so she didn't find out about her culture until her 40s and 50s, there was another story. So it's really anything about citizens, you know, reconnecting with their culture or with their own tribe. But, you know, we don't just share citizen stories, but we also love to utilize the talents of our citizens. So Bobby Lynn, he's a citizen here, and he creates all the music for it.
All right, let's hear a clip from what is actually a two-part, two-episode story titled Addiction Does Not Discriminate.
I knew a lot of things were going bad in my life once I'd even been clean for enough time to really think about it. I'm not very old, you know, I'm 25 years old. I had realized that my life had just been stalled out, or I wasn't going anywhere, I wasn't doing anything. I just, like, started isolating myself from even my close friends.
All right, Kyla, tell us more about Jacob Miller's story and his mother, Marcy.
Yeah, so this was a part of our opiate awareness and prevention campaign that we, the tribe, received a grant for. And Jacob and Marcy volunteered to share their story, which was really, you know, it was a big decision for them because no one knew in the tribe that Jacob had dealt with his heroin addiction and Marcy had kept it secret too. Jacob, he at 14 got a hold of a Vicodin at a party, pretty innocent among friends, and then he became addicted immediately. And so he switched to heroin intravenously a couple years later, and then that was six years of his life, just heroin. You know, as he said in the podcast, nothing happened. He had sold most of his possessions and anything good his hands on. And so coming out with this story, they've received such positive feedback from the community, from other citizens who have dealt with this or whose family is dealing with opiate addiction. And so now, his life now is just amazing. We're going to come out with a part 3 for him and Marcy because their stories have changed and grown, and you'll find out about that hopefully soon. But Marcy, you know, his mom just watching her child addicted to a drug that could kill him, and it was heartbreaking for her. And now their relationship, though, has stayed so close, and it's amazing to see what life after addiction can be.
It's so emotional and so sensitive and personal, but they wanted to share their story with you and this podcast, which says a lot about what it means to the tribe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we're not afraid to share some of these stories that are harder to tell because there's always life after. You know, someone's story doesn't end in their addiction or in heartbreak. There's always a part 2. There's always something that comes next. And so we love sharing what comes after. And we've actually had at least one citizen come to the behavioral health clinic and have started treatment for opiate addiction. So that is what it's all about, really. That's the biggest triumph we could see.
Now, you are non-Native, correct?
Correct.
What brought you to this work with the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi?
You know, it's not that interesting of a story, but I saw an ad for the job and applied, and here I am. The tribe hires a lot of citizens, but it is a pretty balanced mix of citizen and non-citizen, and it feels like a family, though. It feels like I'm a part of it being here.
The podcast is called Yash Monen, which means stories put on by my guest, Kyla Canera, who's the digital communication specialist for the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. And we have put links for you to be able to find this podcast on our website at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Kyla, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This is the time of year when the for sale signs start popping up with the crocuses and tulips. At least that's what usually happens come springtime, but that's not necessarily the case this home buying season in the Grand Rapids area. Ryan Ogle is here to tell us what's going on. He's president of the Greater Regional Alliance of Realtors. Ryan Ogle, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What words would you use right now, Ryan, to describe the state of the housing market in Grand Rapids in West Michigan?
Well, we have an inventory crisis, so that would be the best way to describe it. But also, you'll hear realtors say there's a logjam in the market.
Okay, a logjam. So what is causing this logjam?
Well, we have more buyers than we have homes for sale. And where the logjam gets started is the people who are interested in selling their house in 2018 won't let us put their home up for sale until we find them one to buy. And that kind of perpetuates this logjam of the market moving, because we need those first-time home buyers to be able to buy the houses of these move-up buyers, but the move-up buyers won't list until they find the next house. And you just kind of have a cycle there. But it's interesting. We kind of have a perfect storm, and if you talk to the public and realtors out there, they'd say it's a good market, and it's kind of known that Grand Rapids is doing well and prices are up, and typically people would say, well, that's a great real estate market. It is, but it creates other challenges of what can you sell all these people who want to live in Grand Rapids.
And in addition to that, what else is going on?
Well, in addition to that, we have people moving to West Michigan. So we have more people coming in, and we weren't prepared for that. When we came out of the recession, when the housing market had crashed, we didn't have the new plats of land developed for lots for builders to build on. So we weren't ready for this demand of people coming here. And a lot of our companies here in the West Michigan area are doing well and are hiring, and people are moving in for that. And then also the colleges are doing well. More students are coming for school, and that takes up some of the homes because investors can rent houses out versus sell them.
As I was looking at some numbers, and I noticed the average price of a pending home sale now is something in the $208,000, $209,000 range. Does that sound about right?
That is correct. That was last month's stats, correct.
And then when you go back to 2009, it was just a little over $107,000. That's quite an increase.
Very much so.
And that's not motivating people to say, you know what, maybe I should sell that and make some money. People are hanging on to their homes anyway?
Yeah, and I think it's two parts to that. If you're in the real estate world, you're privy to what's going on in the market. And if you happen to be, you know, someone from the public who's looking to buy or sell a house, you know about the current market and the values and conditions. But for the average homeowner, if they weren't really looking to sell and they aren't like best friends with the real estate agent, they have no idea what the average prices are. A lot of people aren't paying attention to that until they're actually ready to jump in the market. So I think a big part of the solution to, you know, maybe helping this logjam burst loose is getting the information out there, awareness to these sellers, like, hey, you could sell your house and make a pretty decent amount of money right now.
I'm just, yeah, with increased homeowner or home values like that, I have to wonder why aren't older homeowners, I guess I'm talking to my generation, hey, baby boomers,
yep.
Why aren't they selling and downsizing? What's going on there?
Yeah, so a classic example would be myself. I live on a block in a very popular neighborhood where they built a new elementary school. So there's a lot of younger families that want to move into that neighborhood so their kids can go to school there and you can live right by the school and park, right? And on my own block, I have three empty nesters who've lived there probably over 20 years. Kids are out of the house and the home's probably too big for them. And they would say, hey, Ryan, you can sell my house, but find me an affordable $200,000, $250,000 condo somewhere that we can move into. And I can't find them that right now. So then it's natural for them to say, well, I'll just stay here in my home that I don't owe anything on.
which I can't fault that, but as you say, it makes it hard when people are coming in and wanting homes. And so I saw one figure that said this past January, there were 1,212 homes listed.
Yes. Yep. And that's just over a month's worth of inventory. So that's an all-time low for us.
And when I look back further, in 2009, there were 11,000 homes.
Correct.
All right. That says the story. So what can be done? Why aren't builders building with all this demand? Why isn't there just a burst of building?
So builders are building. I think builders, though, can pick and choose what they want to build right now because there's a lot of demand. And if you're a builder and you can pick and choose the market you're going to build in a price range or build for clients where you're going to make a decent amount of money on it. And I think a lot of builders are choosing a higher-end home to build. And then also, you know, part of the issue, too, is there's a need for better trades and tradespeople in the area. So I think a lot of builders are lacking the right support crews and, you know, the framers and the painters and the plumbers and some of those trade services that they need to build at a higher level of production.
But yet I see that the Grand Rapids market is considered undervalued. Why is that?
Well, I think compared to the rest of the country, we were way undervalued to begin with. So even though we've had such a dramatic increase in price from 2009 till now, like you pointed out, we still are pretty affordable, especially if you're moving here from a bigger metro market like Atlanta or Chicago. You can look at some of these homes here, and 209, yeah, it's gone up, and that's a decent price for people from around here. But if you're coming from that outside market, it's still a heck of a deal.
Yes. I know prices in Chicago, and you're absolutely right. How's the rental market, by the way?
So that's the interesting part, right? Because sometimes the housing market's up and the rental market's down, or vice versa. The rental market's up and the housing market's down. Right now, they're both up. And that's part of the problem. If I go back to the example of the neighbors on my block, you know, if the answer is, hey, I can't find you a nice $250,000 condo to move into, okay, well, maybe we'll rent a place downtown. And then I let them know that a two-bedroom apartment downtown is $2,000 a month.
And that's the end of that conversation, isn't it?
And that's the end of that conversation. So now we're back to them saying, well, you know what? We'll just stay in our house that we like. That is a little too big for us, but it's paid off and we don't have to move, right? And in that kind of age range, too, they're not ready to move on to the retirement home or this, you know, that step. So you need that in-between market of, hey, sell the two-story that you raised your kids in. And yeah, downsizer. So it's an interesting situation. There's so many variables and factors to it, but it's kind of like the perfect storm, and that's where this logjam gets created.
So, Ryan, as the president of the Grand Rapids Association of Realtors, what's your best guess as to how this market will balance out and how long that will take? What will it take and how long?
Yeah, the million-dollar question, right? That's a hard one. I think even right now, just as we're kind of getting into spring, we're starting to see a few more homes come on the market. So that will help out a little bit. That will let some of the tension and pressure off as more people just naturally list in the spring. But I don't think it's going to solve the problem. West Michigan has a lot of good going for it. For those other factors that I mentioned, the companies are hiring, the colleges are doing well. There's just a lot of good going on. People are moving here from out of state. And so I think the demand's going to keep growing too. So it's going to be 2 years, I think, because even if you were to start to build, you know, some houses tomorrow, it's typically a 9-month process. So that takes a little bit of time. But before a builder can build, usually, you know, a developer has to go in and lay the infrastructure to put in cul-de-sac in the road and have the lots available. And that takes a couple months. So right there, just to, you know, start a new development and build a house is probably over a year's time. So I'm thinking personally it's going to be about 2 years before maybe we can really catch up. But it could just be an ongoing problem. Grand Rapids has done very well. And if you've paid attention to the news, we're top 10 in all these different categories. You know, top 10 place to land a job out of college, top 10 place for millennials, and, you know, top 10 in a lot of things. Well, when you that attraction like that nationally, it works. So people want to move here. So I think people will be moving here for a while, and it might just be something that we're going to be dealing with, that it's a tight housing market as we go from this small Midwest town to a little bit of a bigger city.
And what's the best piece of advice you could give, particularly millennial, a first-time home buyer that is, you know, wants to come and work in the Grand Rapids area and buy in the Grand Rapids area? What's the most important piece of advice you give them?
Well, they need a backup plan. they need a family friend or someone here. They need a short-term month-to-month apartment or some kind of backup plan so they do have a roof over their head while they're looking to buy a home. And then also, you know, when you're writing offers and you're competing, you have to really dial into the different aspects of an offer to what makes one offer better than another one. And it's not always price. Sometimes it's the larger down payment or a shorter inspection window. There's some different things you can do to make your offer attractive. So with millennials, if they truly have some money set aside, they can write a larger good faith deposit when they write an offer. Or maybe they can put more money down, which in return kind of shows their offer as stronger. So I think millennials setting some money aside to buy their first house is going to put them in a good position to be competitive if they find themselves in that situation.
Ryan Ogle is the president of the Greater Regional Alliance of Realtors based there in Grand Rapids. We want to thank you so much, Ryan, for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, we hear from a graduate of the Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. She stepped forward with allegations of inappropriate behavior by its former dean, William Strample. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This next interview deals with a sensitive topic and could be disturbing to some listeners. The scandal surrounding Michigan State University deepened last week with the arrest of the former dean of its College of Osteopathic Medicine. William Strample was arraigned on charges of fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct, counts of misconduct in office, and willful neglect of duty related to his failure to supervise sports doctor Larry Nassar, and accusations by four women of sexual harassment. The Detroit News this week reports Strample's performance review indicated he had a history of talking about sexual matters, commenting on the personal appearance of students, and that was in a 2010 review. Dr. Brianna O'Keefe is a graduate of the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine. She has stepped forward with allegations about Strample's behavior towards her, and she is with us now. Dr. O'Keefe, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what years did you attend MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine?
I attended MSUCOM from 2008 to 2012.
All right. And what were your thoughts when you first heard the news that the former dean had been arrested and is going to be facing all these charges?
I wasn't overly surprised. I think I was more shocked that he was actually finally arrested. And, you know, of course, disappointed because that's a representative of our school. But like I said, I wasn't surprised just based on the behavior he had towards me and other students during my time at MSUCOM.
And I want to get into that. But first, could you describe for us then-Dean Strample's behavior as the public face of the college?
So I think he was more viewed as this great leader who was expanding our campuses. He was expanding the college. They opened two new campuses my second year there. They were working on expanding osteopathic medicine to Canada and looking at other states to open, like, sister schools. And he was always pushing the envelope. So I think as far as what the public saw, they thought he was this great leader and this visionary who was bringing MSUCOM up to the next level.
And then how would you describe his behavior towards you in your years there as a student?
Initially, I was always very intimidated by him. He had a very harsh, gruff personality, made it very clear that he wasn't somebody to really go to if you needed something. And if you did bother him, there was an expectation that it better be pretty darn important or you were going to be in trouble. My personal interactions with him really started when I first had to meet with him after I found out I was pregnant. And I found out I was pregnant right after the deadline for applying for special consideration to stay in the area. So obviously I couldn't apply. So I asked if I could meet with him to discuss the situation since my then husband was based here in the Lansing area. And I knew it wasn't going to really be practical for me to have a newborn baby away on clinicals when I'm, you know, in the ER at 3 a.m.
Not at all. And what year was this of your?
That was 2009.
Okay. And what happened then?
So I had emailed and requested to meet with him, and I received an email back from him stating that he would meet with me, but if I wanted to get what I want, I better wear a low-cut shirt. Shortly after that, I got an email from his assistant who asked me to schedule an appointment with him.
Now, you said he'd been somebody who seemed gruff, a little bit scary, and then you got that email telling you to wear a low-cut shirt.
I wasn't necessarily surprised by the email just because of the crude jokes he would tell even in a public forum, but I was really nervous because I had no intention of wearing a low-cut shirt, even if I really needed something for me that was not something I was ever willing to do. But I definitely was scared that here I'm going into a meeting with somebody that already makes me nervous without having an expectation of something that I'm going to wear, and then I'm going to show up not wearing it and asking him for help.
And what happened in the meeting?
He was extremely hostile towards me. He berated me for even asking for help, commented several times about how I knew how pregnancy happens, or I should know since I was a medical student, and I should have taken precautions to prevent that. And then basically said, like, don't ask me for this. You just need to go through the general lottery, which is the process we have to select which hospital we go to. And had made a comment about, well, I guess if that doesn't work out, then maybe you can contact me again. The meeting didn't last very long, 10, maybe 15 minutes at most, because once he started launching into me, there was really nothing else for me to say to him.
And as a medical student, what did you think might happen if you were to push back or try to call him out for this type of behavior?
Well, I was worried that it was going to adversely affect my medical career. I mean, this is somebody who has had a lot of respect in the community, and especially the community that I was living in and raised in, because I grew up just outside of East Lansing. And I wanted to stay in that community. And so if I reported him or if I spoke out against him, no one's going to listen to me. I'm a lowly second-year medical student versus Dean Strample.
Something happened when Dean Strample was addressing the college, including all the satellite sites. And you said this was one of the most humiliating moments of your life. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. We were having a meeting, and I can't recall what it was about, but it was mandatory for us to all be there. And so he was projecting it to two satellite sites in addition to my class and the first-year students, because I was in my second year at the time. So we had administrators there. You know, hundreds of people are tuned into this. And he started out talking about how one of his administrative assistants had told him he can't call us kids because we're not his kids. He said, well, everybody but Brianna's baby, that's my baby. And then just kept on talking about something else. And I was shocked.
What did other people say to you?
Well, my friends who were right next to me and obviously knew it wasn't true were just like, oh my gosh, Bree, we're so sorry. And I mean, I turned beet red, and it was all I could do not to just burst out in tears in front of everybody. I definitely heard people moving in their chairs, whispering. The first chance I had, as soon as we had a break, I ran to the bathroom and cried. After I composed myself, people were like, oh, well, no wonder your grades are so high, or no wonder you got to stay in Lansing because you're sleeping with the dean. And, you know, other people were like, is that true? I can't believe you do that. And, you know, even people that knew me, even if they didn't question me directly, like, it put that thought into people's brains. And for me, not only was it humiliating to be accused of having an affair, cheating on my husband, and getting pregnant by somebody else, anybody else, but then our dean of our medical school, in that moment, he undermined years of hard work that I had put in towards getting good grades, studying hard, working hard, to build a reputation of being somebody who was always going to work hard and do their best. And it basically just put out there that I'd slept my way through medical school.
Dr. O'Keefe, the Detroit News got hold of portions of a 2010 performance review of William Strample, and the paper has reported there were multiple comments in the file from other faculty and students and staff documenting similar behavior and attitude towards women that you describe. What are your thoughts knowing that that dates back to 2010?
I mean, it's devastating because, you know, here we are 2018, even after everything with Larry Nassar came out, and it came out that he hadn't been appropriately supervising him. Nobody did anything. People knew that this was happening. People knew it wasn't right. This wasn't just a, well, this is the way it is. It never should have been that way. And I do feel like a lot of my fellow students and colleagues kind of acquiesced to his behavior because we felt like that's what we had to do. You know, here we've put a lot of time and money and resources into being in medical school here. We don't want to ruin our career. But when I find out that other faculty and administrators knew about this, and these reviews are meant to determine how well he's doing in determine whether or not he's going to keep working there. And nobody did anything. It never went any further. You know, nobody contacted me to ask me, you know, about any of this stuff. We never got an email or a survey sent to us about his behavior. They could have stopped it at any point, and they never did, because apparently making money and expanding the college was more important. At least that's how it feels to me.
And given your experience as a student at the College of Osteopathic Medicine over this last year or so as you heard Spartan officials and attorneys insisting that the scandal was isolated and the only one involved in this behavior was one man, and that was Larry Nassar. What did you think as you saw that unfold?
That was really tough because I had worked with Larry before, and I had worked with the sports med group, even when they're in high school, and I shadowed them through college and in medical school and residency, and I know that there's a really good core group of people there. And, you know, even when I had worked with Dr. Nassar as a medical student or resident and going in rooms with them, you know, that's not behavior I ever saw. And so the first part, I just thought, here's a really sick man who did a lot of really sick things, but nobody knew. And then as I started finding out more about previous reports that he had been abusing other women and no supervision occurred, that makes me sick to my stomach because there were years where these women and children were subjected to him preying on them. Somebody knew, you know, Dean Strample at the very least was supposed to be supervising him and never did.
How would you like to see MSU respond?
I do think that they're doing a good job now. I appreciate that President Engler did take actions to fire him when he came on board initially. I've actually talked with Dr. Amalfitano, who's acting as interim dean at MSU-Com, not necessarily just about Dean Strample, but about how MSU needs to build up. And I know from my conversation with him that he really wants transparency. And I think that's so important. I would like to see the higher ups at MSU, whether it be the board or whomever, be more supportive and at least take some accountability that even if they didn't know what was going on, there were reviews being done. There were complaints. That should have been followed up on. They're on the board because they're supposed to be taking care of how MSU is run. And if they're not doing that, they're not doing their job.
Dr. Brianna O'Keefe, graduate of the Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. O'Keefe, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
One note, MSU and William Strample's attorney did not immediately respond to our request for comment. And staying with the MSU scandal, we have new details about Larry Nassar, thanks to Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, who has been covering this story for us. Kate, welcome back.
Hi, Cindy. So what we just published today, actually, are the 2016 police reports that MSU police did into Larry Nassar. As you remember, this is finally the police investigation that actually brings him down. And until now, I've not been able to actually read through everything that police wrote in their reports and knew in detail about the investigation they were doing into Nassar, how they essentially were able to finally bring him to justice. So that's what we've got here. And there were definitely some new insights in there that at least I was not aware of up until now.
Well, among them, you give us examples of Larry Nassar's Google search history.
Yeah.
What'd you find?
Those obviously were pretty disturbing. And we should say nothing in them that we're going to say now is pornographic because we know that Nassar was later sentenced for child pornography possession. What these Google searches do show us is that in 2016, before Nassar was arrested, he was telling authorities and had been telling authorities for years that, look, what I do here, these pelvic floor examinations, they're legitimate. Meanwhile, he's searching things like pelvic floor manipulations in athletes, legal use of medical exam gloves, and just the flat out, is it illegal not to use gloves with intervaginal manipulations? Intervaginal manipulations for back pain, vaginal massage. So this would appear to be a guy who was looking for evidence to back up his claim.
And you also had the chance to read the police notes of what he was doing under questioning.
Yeah, that was actually, so police brought Nassar in 2016, soon after Rachel Denhollander had come forward. And we actually saw the video of Nassar being interviewed that time. The prosecution played it in court, and it is worth seeing, or at least very least worth reading on this end. The guy falls apart under questioning, which is interesting because in 2014, when there was a previous complaint, he was able to basically walk out of there and convince police and prosecution that what he was doing was legitimate. But the difference is that in 2016, Rachel Denhollander has come forward and she has receipts. She has gone through her entire medical record. She has kept journals for years. She has become essentially an expert on pelvic floor manipulation. And she also has the fact that her and her mother witnessed Nassar have an erection during two treatments. And that is something that police are able to bring up multiple times in this interview with Nassar. And he falls apart. he starts off in this interview when they ask him, you know, why would they see you with an erection during treatment? He says, obviously, you wouldn't have an erection. That wouldn't be professional. And then by the end of it, they notice that he is stuttering, that his foot is tapping. He's finally saying, I mean, if there was arousal, it would be because of whatever. When you're a guy, sometimes you get an erection. It's embarrassing to have that happen. So you see his story start to unravel in real time.
Which takes us right back to the importance of Rachel Denhollander, the former Olympic gymnast, and pressing this forward the way she did, as you say, with the research she did that made a difference in the questioning.
Absolutely. And a police detective, Andrea Munford, who believed her, who was willing to take this story and press Nassar with it multiple times to come in and be skeptical of what Nassar was selling.
You've also learned more about how two of Larry Nassar's colleagues at the College of Osteopathic Medicine, COM, responded. First, Dr. Brooke Lemon. Remind us who she is and tell us what you learned.
So Dr. Brooke Lemon has been a key figure in this for a long time. She was a very close friend of Nassar's. She kind of considered him her mentor. They worked together at MSU Sports Medicine, and she had learned a lot from him. And when these accusations from Denhollander and other women start coming out in 2016, Nassar calls Dr. Lemon and says, look, I'm trying to figure out who some of these complainants are. They're filed as Jane Does. I want to go pick up my medical records, but I can't because I've got reporters all over my house. Can you just go to the office and pick up some of these medical records that might help me figure out who's accusing me? And Dr. Lemon tells police that she goes, she picks up these files, and then at some point, she starts to have second thoughts and think, maybe this is not a good idea for Larry to have these files. She takes them home overnight, and then the next day, calls an administrator at MSU and says, I want to run this by you before I give them to Larry. What do you think? And that administrator says, bring them right back immediately, and essentially puts them under a lock and key. And police talk with Lemon about, you know, why she did this, and she talks about how conflicted she was at that time about these accusations coming out against Nassar. You know, she says, like, I tell him that I love him. And she also has an interesting line where she says, this is a friend that's going through a crappy time. If he is guilty, that is bad. We all sin. Some sins might be felt to be worse than others. I'm not that judge. I'm still a friend. So you see the real effect that this is having on people who had trusted Nassar.
And you also found out some information about Dr. Jeffrey Kovan, who is the director of sports medicine performance at MSU. What did you learn?
He was the director at that time. So he was fairly high up the chain at MSU. And Kovan, when he's talking to investigators in 2016, when police come interview him, at that point, multiple women had come forward. But Kovan is still very disbelieving. He is saying essentially that these women must have just misunderstood what happened to them, that he's not sure if Nassar even did anything wrong. He says Nassar is a good person with a good core. Nassar is too good of a person with the right intentions to end up in prison. And he's very dismissive of the idea that these women would be actually legitimate in their claims.
Dr. Lemon resigned.
Yes, Dr. Lemon was later allowed to resign. Dr. Kovan, however, at least according to MSU's website, is still faculty there.
So what does all this new information mean, do you think, for the larger story?
Well, I think what we're able to do now that the criminal investigation is officially closed is we're able to take a beat and look at what it was that actually brought Nassar to justice. And hopefully that will give us lessons on how to be able to stop this in future cases.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Kate, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.